Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan, Prof's Eidetic Memory, Sachs. Ethan, this is your jam in both Vintage Cube and Arena Cube when it's there. Sometimes it hasn't been there.
Yeah.
But, you're a Prof's lover.
I am a Prof's lover. I think, it's so funny. I had a real, I'm never drafting blue in Vintage Cube era of my life when I was all about the Jund, tier two cards. And I also truly always hated Splinter Twin. Splinter Twin was in the cube. Splinter Twin, Kiki Jiki, and Exarch, Pestermite, et cetera, were in the cube for a long time, and I hated them. I hate, certainly hate losing to it, but, that as a strategy is not fun for me at all to just be able to be like, oops, here's a two-card combo, I win. But those are gone, and now blue-red is really fun.
And blue red tempo.
I think blue red tempo with with Profts and Inti and Dragon Rage Channeler and really cheap, basically
get blue some bobbles red in there.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I have drafted blue red or / Jeskai Lurrus more than once because that deck just sort of lends itself to you're just drafting all one and two drops. And it's I can companion Lurrus here. Why not? That is probably my favorite deck in the cube right now. So
yeah. Is there a card like that for me? You don't know my Vintage Cube life. You haven't seen me Vintage Cube, I guess. I'm not as vocal about when I've been cubing. Do you have a card like that in mind for me?
No, I don't know what you like. What's your kink these days in Vintage Cube?
I'm trying to think what it would be. I think it would be, I love a good Thoughtseize. I really like black disruptive decks. If I can't go fast, I really want to try to disrupt my opponents.
And are you but in that dream, would you want Thoughtseize and Duress and Inquisition and Sculler? Yes. And Freebooter?
Yes, as many of them, but the bat more than anything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's great. That's Sculler's washed. Sculler used to be my pet card.
Sculler is washed. Yeah. No, Deep Cavern Bat is very, very good. We're really not going to be talking much about Vintage Cube today, but we will be talking about all things Cube. We have a very exciting episode, a very cool interview coming up with the hosts of another podcast called Lucky Paper Radio. Andy and Anthony joined me last week for a really awesome conversation about Cube. If just as a little backstory, their podcast is mostly it's a Cube podcast, but it's not really about how to win at Cube. It's about it's about designing. And they talk a lot about designing cubes and they will give, they travel to a lot of these sort of grassroots Cube events. CubeCon is coming up this weekend as sort of maybe the biggest one in the country. But so they travel to these events. They'll do tournament reports about the cubes they drafted, but it's not really with a spiky bent, but I get the sense from listening to them that they are thinking about the game in that way. They're clearly trying to win and they have accolades to their names in terms of their runs at these various tournaments, but they've never really done that on the show. And so I did reach out to Andy a few months ago and I was like, hey, I really like your show. I would like to talk to you guys about how to win at new cubes, because I've had the experience certainly of drafting new cubes online, but dipping my toe into this cube life last year when I did commentary at KubeCon and, you know, met up with, went to the Steel City Cube event that was here in Pittsburgh, had experience with like drafting some weird cubes. And as I'll say in the interview, I have the experience that I have when I play a new board game, which is like about three quarters of the way through. I'm like, oh, I get it.
I should have done X. Can we scrap this and re-go again?
Exactly. But you don't have that opportunity when you're going to these events. You get paired into a cube and you get to draft it once. And like, there can be few people in the world that are as well versed in this experience as these two hosts were. And I really wanted the opportunity to be like, what do you do? Like, what are you looking at when you look at a cube list? What are you thinking about when you sit down to a new cube for the first time? Which I think can be applicable not only to those events, but to if you sit down to draft a new cube on Arena for the first time, or you're going to try and draft the Vintage Cube for the first time. Like, I think this stuff does apply. And even better, there are some macro takeaways that I think apply to just card evaluation or set evaluation, draft evaluation for regular limited formats as well. So I'm excited for folks to hear this interview. I'm excited for you to hear the interview because you're a busy boy and weren't able to make it. And I'd be curious because they, as I was telling you, they just come from a totally different world than us. Like, you and I draft the digital cubes that are on offer.
Correct.
These guys don't.
Yeah, you told me off air that they only play paper, and I was like, what? What is this unicorn? Like, how does somebody end up only playing paper who likes cube? Like, how would you not want to play Vintage Cube on Magic Online? Or how would you not want to play the Arena Cube? It's so convenient, but truly a rarity that somebody, or at least feels strange to me as somebody who is a primarily digital player, and I'm sure they would have a similar reaction to me.
Yeah. No, I think it's a cool experience, really cool conversation. It went like, I was like, we'll maybe chat for like 45 minutes, an hour. And we went well over an hour. And like, I could have talked to them for two more hours about the same topic. Like, it's cool to feel like because this community or this game attracts so many different kinds of people, it's rare to find your people. Like, I found like Ben is my people. That's as evidenced by our years and years of being on the show together. And I just got the sense from listening to their podcast, I was like, I feel like I would get along with these guys, even though we just like we engage with this game in pretty different ways, even though we're both playing limited and we both like cube, like we're engaging with the game in pretty different ways, but I still like really vibed with them. And I think folks are going to have a good time listening.
Yeah. I'm excited to listen to it.
So just quick housekeeping before we drop the interview, Patreon.com/Lords of Limited is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. Great perks over at the Patreon page, including access to our Discord, which is just a great community of like-minded limited individuals, and access to our podcast feed where you get not only this episode a day early ad-free, but also our weekly bonus episode of Lords Unlimited. If any or all of that sounds of interest to you, head on over to the Patreon page. We're recording this early, so we'll just make sure that we shout out our new patrons next week. And this time we will just say to all past, present, and future patrons, thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, cannot say thank you enough. And fresh off of Magic Atlanta, it was awesome meeting people in person who listened to the show, who said thanks for the show, who just came up and said, hey, listen to the podcast, or sometimes it was a very brief interaction, sometimes it was a long interaction, and all of them are appreciated. Truly, we can't say thank you enough for listening and supporting the show.
Yeah. Without further ado, let's get into the interview. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. October 10th is World Mental Health Day, and this year we're saying thank you, therapists. My therapist has helped me in many ways. I think I had a preconceived notion about what therapy was like I tell you my problems I'm having and you give me the tools to solve them or whatever. And in a way that's true, but it's so much more about noticing when I'm being reactive or when I'm doing something voluntarily versus doing something to manage anxiety or when I'm over-functioning in a relationship. And she puts all of that under the lens of it's information, which has been really eye-opening for me as a way of looking at things. The right therapist can change everything, and BetterHelp has 12 plus years experience in matching people to the right therapist. This World Mental Health Day, we're celebrating the therapists who have helped millions of people take a step forward. If you're ready to find the right therapist for you, BetterHelp can help you start the journey. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/lords. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/lords. And now back to the show. All right, I am very excited to welcome the hosts of Lucky Paper Radio. Andy, I got 99 problems, but an ornithopter ain't one, Mangold. And Anthony, what are we fermenting today, Maddox?
That's the first time anyone's given me a nickname.
Is that a serious question? Because
I am curious. Maybe we'll save that to the end.
Well, yeah, we'll come to that.
I've peeped the shelves and the jars. I'm very intrigued by what's going on in the kitchen.
That's some forward sizzle. So if you want to hear what Anthony's got pickling in jars in his kitchen, you got to wait to the very end of the podcast. And we'll talk about that then. Wow, I feel like no one's ever given me a nickname before. I feel so honored. This is great.
I'm glad to get to repay, the debt that you've given Anthony many, many times. Guys, welcome to the show. I'm a huge fan. I'm going to sort of go into slightly a long preamble here, and then we're going to get into the meat of the episode here, because I want to sort of set the stage for why I decided to reach out to Andy a few months ago. And I was like, I kind of want to do an episode. I don't know when's the right time. Would you guys be interested? And have gotten sort of a resounding yes to this. So
yeah, we're very honored. Before you do your look preamble, just thank you for having us on. This is a great honor for us.
People
very rarely reach out to us and ask how to do well at magic. So I don't know. It's great. It's exciting. And it's an interesting angle on this we don't usually talk about. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm a fan of your show. I've been listening for a little over a year. For anyone who is out there who has not checked out Lucky Paper Radio, I highly recommend it. They're consistent, crisp, episode every week. Shout out to fellow Monday release podcasts. It's a great time. It's a great listen. The cold opens are great. I'm going to shout those out in a world of magic content that usually makes me cringe. I will say that those do not. I especially want to highlight the line for line Glengarry, Glenn Ross, Alec Baldwin monologue, but also y'all's sort of like principled stances. It's very aspirational. I'm often in awe of the things that you do on your show. Your show is also primarily directed towards people who are not me. They're people who are, curating their own cube, fostering their cube communities, either people who are cube designers or trying to, tackle some sort of cube community in paper. And that is not me. I'm a primarily, nearly exclusively online player. You had an episode of a few months ago, maybe, about how vintage cube sort of gives the cube community, I'm going to use my own words, but a bad rap. And I was like, hey, wait, that's me. I engage with basically just vintage cube on Magic Online, but still really, really enjoy the show. And I was curious about your opinion on sort of the spiky aspect of cube. I know you both travel the country to these various grassroots cube tournaments. You host weekly cube nights. You have a ton of experience drafting new cubes, often citing that your only criteria for picking cubes to draft at these grassroots tournaments is that they are ones you haven't drafted before. And I want to just give a little background of my sort of brush with this larger cube community that I had last year. Greg, aka Dinrova Horror, he's a Pittsburgher, and that's where I'm from. I've gone to one of his weekly cube events. I've drafted his companion cube, which I'll describe in just a little bit, in anticipation of going to the Steel City cube event last summer, where I also had the opportunity to draft Judge Bones' Iganjo Drift cube. So I want to give some sort of preambles here to folks about what those cubes are. So companion
cube, mean.
Yeah. So companion cube is a cube where you may have any card in your deck as your commander, and it's old companion rules, so you don't have to pay the 3 to put it into your hand, and you may swap commanders from game to game if you want to sideboard and make changes for what your commander is. And Iganjo Drift is a cube where each player starts with the card Mech Hanger in play. So everybody has that card in play. I also had the chance to commentate Judge Bones' War of the Spark cube at KubeCon last year, which is a sort of similar thing. It's 100 planeswalkers. There's a similar rule where each person starts with a copy of Interplanar Beacon in play. And now we'll be talking about more than just these sort of funky rules cubes or these sort of, and I'm curious if you even have a word for these. I know you have what's clown shoes. Maybe that is this
people
category of cubes.
People are mad at us about a lot of things, but I think
people on the internet being mad about content can't be true.
I think the better name is like context shift cubes is the most descriptive name. It's not very snappy. You know, it's not going to be super memorable, but really that's what they are, is like some cube that has some dramatic theme or modification to it that like radically recontextualizes cards. And very often these are cards or cubes rather where the rules are actually modified, right? You start with land in play, or you can have any card be your companion. But Myo 100 Ornithopter is just a great example of a cube that has no modified rules, but is just as zany as all those other cubes just because of the nature of the way it's constructed. So you can get there a couple different ways, and really the thing that ties them all together is just that the context is radically different than what you're used to. So card evaluation is like you're starting all over again from first principles kind of when you're evaluating cards.
Right. Well, and so I had an experience with sort of all three of those cubes, or I'll say both of the cubes that I drafted, not the one I commentated, which was sort of like an experience I have, you know, when you play a board game for the first time, where about three quarters of the way through playing the game, you go, oh, I get it. Can we play again?
Right.
And I feel like I did that during the companion cube. I was like about halfway through my second match, I was like, oh, I get how this shifts. Like it really, because you know you always have this card, it makes it feel more, it's like more constructed than it is limited, because you always have access to this card. It's a lot like you have four copies of it in your deck. Or for those cubes where you start with the land in play, you have this real weird mental shift, especially with those two I cited, the Mech Hanger and Interplanar Beacon. You have to make this mental shift that any single pipped vehicle or any single pipped planeswalker in those cubes are colorless because you can cast them with those lands. And that is not something that is readily apparent. Now, obviously, those kinds of things you'll get used to as you approach cubes. But those kinds of feelings I had where I was like, okay, I'm about three quarters of the way through my cube experience, and I would like to do it again because I realize I didn't approach this optimally. Mm-hmm. And that's often been my sort of advice, or dovetails into the advice, you know, if people on stream or in our Discord would ask, like, what's like, how do you get into cube for the first time? It's not an uncommon question we've received. And for stuff like Magic Online cubes or Magic Arena cubes, I'd be like, find an archetype you like, draft that, you know, a handful of times. And in those times where you're drafting that archetype, you'll see most of the cards in the cube. You'll face a wide variety of archetypes in your runs, and you'll get a sense for what's going on in that cube. But in these pop-up events, and maybe slash for people who want to engage with cube, they don't have the time or resources for things like that. And you all are, I can't think of, you know, folks who have experienced new cubes more, perhaps. I'm sure there are folks out there, but you have to be among those, the people who have experienced new cube environments time and time again. You have to have some sort of shorthand heuristics for, and maybe not even shorthand, but just some sort of heuristics, go-tos, categories, things you're looking for when you approach a new cube, so that you can go set yourself up the best for success. And that was sort of my springboard for being curious about. It's often when you all are talking about cube on your show, it's a corner of, you know, it's an aspect of approaching cubes that you don't often touch on, but I'm so curious about, you know, when you give your cube reports or your tournament reports, when you come back from one of these various events, I'm always curious about like, okay, but what did you do in the 5 minutes between when Hedron Network said you're going to play this cube and you sat down and you're shuffling, like, what are you doing? So I'm sort of curious about it in that kind of hyper-focused 5 to 10 minute window of prep that maybe you do, but also a sort of broader, here are the things we look for in cubes. And that is my long introduction, and I cede the floor to you, gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth giving some context. I mean, you alluded to this a lot, but cube is really kind of having a moment, like especially in the last, let's say, 2 years, where I think for a long time, cube was primarily just known as this is the Magic Online cube, which is great and has, you know, a huge group of people that love and play that all the time. But there's sort of been this renaissance of a way to engage with cube that is in paper, people building their own cubes, and really just exploring the space of what is possible. And that's everything from just like, I love, you know, fairies and dragons, so I'm going to build a cube that has all my favorite fairies and dragons, to I'm going to do something totally crazy, like the only creature is Ornithopter. And we in our local playgroup, we play cube every single week, and it's going to be something different that we're tackling. We have currently on our cube menu for our local group, I think 55 cubes, and, you know, things cycle in and out. People build new things. And then in addition to our weekly night, there are these kind of regular events that have been popping up. Sort of the big premier one was CubeCon, that sort of set a lot of precedents, answered a lot of questions. solved a lot of challenges, and then other people have sort of taken that up and started their own events, including, I think you mentioned Vertex. And those are just a blast because you show up for a day or two, a weekend event, and just do back-to-back drafts. And it is just like, I think it's so awesome for a certain type of player that loves to, you know, not have access to the data, not have access to the solved problems in the pick order. It's just like, here's a totally fresh draft experience that you're not gonna be able to have anywhere else, and just jump into it and try and solve it. And my strategy, and I think Andy's as well, most of the time, is to go into things pretty much random. Like, don't research the cubes ahead of time. Just, you know, yeah, literally exclude on this custom software that these events use the ones that we are familiar with, and just jump into something that's brand new. And that's a fun challenge.
Yeah, I think also I wanted to speak to just, you mentioned like talking about spikiness as it pertains to cube, which I think is a whole topic in and of itself. But I would say at our core, Anthony and I are actually spikes in the sense that like we love Magic because it is a competitive zero sum game. I think the idea that you are like trying to get better and do the best you can in your seat and like find your outs and like hard positions, like that's why this game is great as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, in that core of like self-improvement and solving problems,
yeah,
it's, we're not necessarily interested in saying like, oh, here's my trophy, here's my accolades, but like knowing that I can sit down at a table and figure out how to navigate that experience, like that's the kind of spike that I think we both are.
Right, but we're very much not spikes in the sense that we have never played a constructed format with any degree of commitment or seriousness. And the last time we were playing Retail Limited regularly, like all my Retail Limited, like serious Retail Limited references go back to like Amonkhet. Like that's when I like knew what the limited format was about. And then I honestly kind of fell off the Retail Limited wagon and fell onto the cube wagon. And so I have no, like my references are going to, people are going to be like, what do you mean Tetsamok Primal Hunger? What even is that card? Your listeners aren't even going to, aren't going to have heard of that. But that used to be the bugbear in Retail Limited. So yeah, I think cube is interesting because like for a certain type of player, the kind of player Anthony and I are, it allows us to have the two parts of Magic that we love the most, which is the sort of creative expression that I think a lot of people are drawn to like Commander for, because you get to like build your deck and like show what you think is cool about Magic, show card interactions you think are really cool, and, you know, kind of curate this like little experience.
Play with your favorite fairies and dragons.
Play with your favorite cards. But it also is a competitive zero-sum game, and I don't want to talk about what Commander is. It's not for me. It's not my favorite format. We don't have to like go down that rabbit hole. But suffice it to say that like I was not getting the sort of competitive zero-sum game aspect and like being able to like challenge myself and feel like I was in a game context where I was meant to be sort of pushing the limits and like trying to find the best of every single possible outcome, but doing that in sort of a context we've designed. So that, which is to say that Anthony and I think have that mentality, but do not have the sort of reps that I think a lot of your listeners will have with a Retail Limited format. That kind of like, let's play the same format, you know, multiple times a week and get really good and learn all the ins and outs of it. That's just not the way that our sort of spiky mentality is ever manifested, which is why I joked earlier that no one's ever come to us for advice on how to be good at Magic, because when it comes to like measurable ways to be good at Magic, we're not that good, right? We don't play any constructed, we don't play any Retail Limited in any serious way. But what we do is sit down and draft a cube we've never seen before and have 5 minutes to look at it. And overall, we do pretty well. I mean, Anthony's got two top eights of these cube events to his name. I've got one, and we tend to go, you know, we win more than we lose.
I'll give myself a little credit that I was also in the top eight at last CubeCon going into the top 128.
Top 120. Oh, you were in the top. That's right. That's
true. Right, I decided to go get dinner instead of actually competing in the next bracket.
I feel like there's been multiple reports of top 64 and I top 128 and then I got ramen instead.
Yes.
So let's not, we can tag those in as other top eights as well.
That's the kind of spicy. That's like spicy. That's the spiciness kind of and spikiness. That we are.
Yeah.
Where Anthony will, you know, have an incredible run at last CubeCon and be in like a 500 player field, like in the top 10, and then be like, I don't want to play in the top 128. That sounds stressful. I'm going to go eat ramen.
I mean, I was fried, to be clear. And I think that this is something else we'll touch on, is sort of one of the things about cube is that it can be grueling. It's like you are looking at 300 cards you've never seen before, potentially, or you've seen a handful of them, and they're all being totally recontextualized. So like doing two drafts in a day can be really exhausting, and doing three in a day is kind of insane.
Well, and certainly, and I have a fraction of an iota of a fraction of the experience that you both have, but to some folks it might sound like two, three drafts in a day, like, but that's, what's the big deal?
But there's a whole additional
part of paper that exists, plus admin for Cube where you're shuffling it, and maybe we'll get to again. Maybe we'll have a fermentation / shuffling masterclass at the end of the episode with
I'll figure out how to synthesize those into one concise topic.
there's the shuffling, there's the taking the deck or the pool picture beforehand, then afterwards, and you know, because you're carrying or you're someone has entrusted their property to you to borrow for these three rounds in this draft. But anyway, the other thing that I wanted to mention was that I think one of the things I've often said to people about is that Cube will just get you better at retail limited, period. I think Cube teaches you, or my experience with Cube has been that it sort of heightens or exacerbates things in limited. Like if you're trying to teach someone about how to draft synergy or cards that work together or drafting a deck with a plan, like Cube just sort of, you know, shows you that with a spotlight. And so I think there's going, even if folks are not necessarily interested in these kinds of, if our listeners are not necessarily interested in these kinds of Cube events, or maybe not necessarily interested in drafting Cubes online, I still think the kinds of things we're going to be talking about are going to apply to card evaluation and trying to see the forest for the trees in a new set and all that stuff, I think is going to come to bear in this conversation.
I really think that's one of the most beautiful things about Magic is that you can learn something about the game in every venue in which it can be played that is like somewhat transportable and applicable, right? Which I love talking to constructed players about my Cube because their perspective on it is totally different. And I can learn so much from somebody that's a competitive grinder in some constructed format when they are evaluating cards for the Cube. And sometimes they're wildly wrong because they don't understand how limited works or how Cube works. But sometimes they also have an insight that's like, I wouldn't have realized that because I don't have your perspective on the game. And I think it's one of the best things about Magic, to be honest.
Preach.
Should we just talk about how we evaluate these Cubes then?
Let's do it. Yes, please.
I feel like the first thing we should do actually is just like define what we mean when we say Cube, which I think everybody listening at this point probably knows, you know, you're basically playing a curated limited set. What I mean more concretely is, you know, you just said that, you know, Cube tends to put a spotlight on, you know, drafting with a plan or, you know, synergistic cards or these sort of like parts that are aspects of retail limited, but not necessarily sort of the main star. And I think it's important to understand kind of just broadly what the sort of range of Cubes looks like, because it's really hard to talk about how to draft Cube successfully because Cube is so many things. Every Cube environment is completely unique, and they range all the way from, you know, the MTGO Vintage Cube people know, where it's like, here are the most powerful cards in Magic's history, and the, you know, interactions between them are going to decide games, and you might lose when one card resolves, and like, it's really kind of swingy, all the way down to like, the most bare bones, like, we have a friend here that has a French Vanilla Cube, where all the creatures are French Vanilla, right? And you might think, well, that's going to be like Magic for babies, but it's actually also quite complicated in its own right and has like a whole different set of considerations, right? You would never evaluate cards the same way in those two environments. Not that they share any cards. I'd be surprised if they did. Maybe like something. But yeah, so what Cube actually is, I think it's like the things that actually differentiate it from Retail Limited, I think most concretely are there's very rarely a massive range between the best and worst cards. I think, you know, this is also more true of Retail Limited, as I understand it. I mean, again, my references to Retail Limited are much dated, but used to be, time was, you didn't even want to play, you know, a third of the cards in a set in your deck in Retail Limited.
Yeah.
Some set of the cards you were just like, I never want this card to be in my deck. The sort of like table stakes for understanding this limited environment is knowing that these cards are unplayable and I should ignore them basically and not even look at them. And that obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, that is not true of almost any Cube because, you know, a Cube is just meant to be drafted. That's why people build them. Retail Limited sets also have to, like, seed cards for Constructed and, you know, be exciting when an 8-year-old buys one at a store and opens it up, just look at the pictures, right? So there's all kinds of jobs that a Retail Limited pack is doing that are not trying to optimize for draft. And one of the side effects is you get cards you just don't want to play in draft. Whereas when you're designing an environment just to draft, all the cards are going to be playable unless the Cube designer has really messed up. And so that's one of the first major differences is that you can basically assume that you're going to have a big offering of viable cards to put in your deck, no matter what color combinations you're playing. And also kind of no matter what the kind of Cube it is. That's true in the Magic Online Vintage Cube. It's true in the French Vanilla Cube. You're going to have a lot of cards that are actually reasonable to play.
Yeah, and I think it's also, it's different in terms of like what are the most powerful and worst cards, but I think there's a even bigger difference if you were to look at like the histogram of the distribution of power level, you know, where in Retail Limited you have your rares that are often very powerful, your uncommons that are a little bit less so, commons a little bit less so. And again, we know Limited is probably different now, but there's still like that kind of structure to it. You can imagine that in a lot of cubes, it's like, okay, everything is kind of at that rare power level or at that uncommon power level or that common power level. And that's a much different experience to navigate. You know, if we just talk about like a pack one, pick one, almost any card could potentially be viable and take you in very different directions in a cube pack. Whereas in a retail limited pack, it's like, okay, is my rare good? Maybe not so much. Let's look at the uncommons. Obviously a simplification, but like, that just is sort of the complexity that cube can bring.
Well, and I think that to sort of maybe bridge the gap from a lot of our listeners, or certainly the world of cube that I primarily come from, if we use vintage cube as the anchor, there is a lot of discourse around I feel like vintage cube is being more and more treated like retail limited, with the, you know, lots of people doing their, here are my top 50 cards that I want to pick in the cube. And, you know, LSV's daily draft videos, he's very mm-hmm. clearly like, these are the cards you could first pick. And I think to a large extent, he's right. And those pick order lists are right in those Power Max cubes. But by and large, I think if you think about cube in that way, you're going to mostly be tripped up when you open a pack of a cube that isn't curated like that, where the power level is often much more flat. You're going to get into a lot of trouble because you're going to be looking for, or I'm obviously speaking from experience, but you're looking for, okay, what's the best card in this pack? Or what signals am I receiving? And you often can't quite get those in the same, you can maybe get the a part of them, but you can't get those two things in the same sort of vein that you get them in a retail limited draft.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, you're drafting the vintage cube. If you see like a Mox, you know that is the powerful card you want to take. If right. you're drafting a cube that has totally different constraints that you've never seen before, you're looking at 15 cards and trying to figure out like, okay, what's power here? Like, what are the outliers? And in one cube, that might be Moxen. In another cube, it might be, oh, a 2-mana, 2/3 Vigilance. In this pack, that seems nuts. Like, that's the kind of card that I'm going to sort of stake my game on. So yeah, I mean, it is a very, very different experience when you're coming to a unique cube.
More broadly, it's interesting because I think cube in the general sense, one of the things I love about it is that it just resists that kind of optimization that you're describing that is kind of going on with a vintage cube. And I think it's fascinating, right? Like, I'm sure somebody at WotC could look at the numbers. And it used to be actually ages ago. Randy Buehler used to be the guy who was in charge of the Vintage Cube back in the early days. Mm. And he did a couple articles in the early days of the Magic Online Vintage Cube, like, I don't know, 2012 or 13 or something, where he was talking about, like, the cards that perform best. And it was basically always mono red at the time. And the thing was, he basically had his analysis was basically came down to the fact that he didn't think most people queued up in the MTGO Vintage Cube to draft mono red. They just didn't want to. Like, it might have been the best thing to do, but they didn't spend their tickets on a Vintage Cube draft to like watch all these sick, amazing cards in Magic's history go by just to take Firebolt over and over again, even if it was the best thing to be doing. And, you know, I think LSV is a great example of, like, obviously, incredible competitive player, incredible competitive mind, who is like applied himself to cube a lot. And it's actually how I first got interested in cube, was watching his videos 8 years ago of drafting the Vintage Cube. And I also think that he has like a very particular perspective, and that perspective is like not the like whole objective truth. And it's also, it works because he's LSV. It's like, LSV can do this and have success at the Vintage Cube because he's one of the greatest players that ever lived. Meanwhile, I always think of Cedric Phillips specifically, used to just force mono white in the Vintage yep. Cube like 3-4 years ago and just trophy 75 to 80% of his drafts. He could just sit down and just get trophies all day. Similar thing. I think most people didn't want to just play 1-mana 2/1s in the Vintage Cube. And so it was an archetype that was just open a lot because people wanted to do sweeter stuff. And so, yeah, if people were playing the Vintage Cube for like, which I guess happens occasionally, they do have like the Vintage Cube champs or whatever. There's occasionally played for really high stakes. But if there was like, I think, a bunch of people and like 17 land style data, you know, about the Vintage Cube, I think maybe that amount of scrutiny and optimization would kind of take a lot of the fun out of for people, because it'd be like, well, actually, the best thing to do is just ignore all the sweet stuff and just kill your opponent so your deck is like hyper consistent, unless you get like the absolute nuts packs. This is kind of a tangent, though. We should probably, whatever. Anyway, that's what I love about cube, is that like That's the vintage cube. That's the cube that is drafted the most of any cube ever in the history of time is a Magic Line vintage cube. And still nobody can agree. The top 50 lists are all totally different. Cedric Phillips is like, just play mono white. LSV is like, if you're not playing blue, you're doing it wrong. And you know, some people agree that like green is unplayable, and then some other drafter has a ton of success with green. And the fact that that one can't, like, there's no consensus on like what is like the actual like big high level best strategy means that when, you know, Anthony and I design a cube, even if we draft it every week, that's, we could do that for 50 years and never get the same amount of drafts the vintage cube has. So the fact that we're playing in this like unsolved space is what I really love about the format.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I had that experience very viscerally the first KubeCon when we were going to have a bunch of people, like very experienced players, playing our own cubes. And I was a little bit nervous, like, oh, they're going to draft this and everybody's going to realize, like, you just got to draft, you know, green white. That's the only deck that makes sense. That's,
you were going to think you had some flaw in your design.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, and people would just like break it and think that, like, well, this cube sucks because there's like a obvious logical solution. And people are playing it for the first time. It's like, no, of course that's not going to happen. Magic is a very complicated game. So there is just so much like depth and forgiveness there, which I really appreciate about Cube.
So let's maybe start there and go from the vintage cube, like power max or power outliers. And maybe that dovetails us into one of the things you're looking for when you sit down to draft a cube for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can maybe, Anthony and I think of an overall kind of similar approach. We have a couple of things we definitely disagree on, which is interesting. But I think when we're drafting a cube for the first time, and very often the context in which we are thinking about this ourselves is, we went to a cube event, there's 25 cubes in the event. All we did was say, I've played these 7 before, don't put me in those, you know, groups. The remaining 18, I haven't even looked at, but I'm going to be playing one of them. The software says you're playing this one. I look at the list for the first time and I have 7 to 10 minutes to like look at it and think about it before I'm opening packs and drafting while they're like shuffling up the cube and everyone's getting settled. That's my time to sort of figure things out. And the first most important thing to do is just figure out, are you in a radical context shift cube? Like, before you start thinking about anything involving card evaluation, you have to figure out, is this a cube where there's some rules modification, where Singleton is broken in some radical way, where it's a desert cube and you have to draft all of your mana sources?
You definitely want to know before you start drafting if you need to draft your basic lands, because you could be in a bad spot.
Yeah, or is it a cube where I can play any card as my companion, right? Any of these sort of radical context shifts, like, you got to, like, that's the first thing you got to do is, like, am I in a cube where, like, something is going to be zany? And you can usually answer that by reading the cube description. And if you can't, then it's a really bad cube description. And I don't want to take for granted that maybe a lot of your listeners have never seen Cube Cobra, but this is the website that every cube designer hosts their cube list on. It is really the only viable website for hosting a cube list. It's just like Moxfield is for decks, but it is for cubes specifically, which have a lot of unique needs and considerations. And so that website, there's a page where like the designer of the cube can write a little, you know, blurb about what the cube is about with pictures or cards referenced. And so I will glance at that. I mean, glance as in I want to like look for the highlights and make sure there's not any crazy rules modifications, because a lot of those blurbs, frankly, they're like an artistic creative expression more than they are a guide for drafting this cube, or at least they shouldn't be taken as that. So that's the first thing I do. And I imagine you do too, is like, is this a radical context shift cube?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you want to understand the rules of engagement in a very literal sense.
That's a much better way to put it. You should like try and figure out the baseline rules of engagement.
And I want to talk about those kinds of, I liked the word zany, those zanier cubes, but maybe we can start with something a little more,
yes,
a little,
let's table that for now,
closer to what folks are maybe used to or used to in theory.
So for me, the next thing I do is, and this is where I really like being on your show, because on our show, like we said, we're mostly talking to other cube designers, people that are working on their own local cube communities. And our show is largely about game design. We're not actually talking about the game from like a very spiky, you know, ruthless perspective, which means here I get to say, a lot of cube designers put cards in their cubes that are too powerful. And the second thing I do is I basically look for any of these cards because I want to either know they're in the environment so I can know to play against them, or I want to draft them myself. And that is mostly, frankly, in 2025, cards from supplemental products that did not go through standard. Those cards are oftentimes way more powerful than other cards in cubes they're involved in. I mean, one of the best examples is if you're drafting an Artifact Matters cube, every single card that has a Warhammer 40K set symbol is probably 50 to 100% better than every other card in the pack, generally speaking, because those cards work as a commander deck. It didn't have to be, it's not even Modern Legal. It goes to Legacy, I guess, but I mean, the bar for being playable in Legacy is so high that a lot of really, really powerful cards sneak by in ways that like are not part of the general Magic discourse. Where if those cards were in retail limited, it would be talked about as like the most nightmarish common in retail limited in the history of time. But it didn't go through a drafted sort of retail set in standard. So somebody saw a common set symbol and put it in their Pauper artifact cube, and now it's just absolutely cracked. So that's the next thing I look for, honestly, is I like, we'll look at the visual spoiler. You can look at the like all the cards in the cube just kind of laid out in a grid. And I'm just like, where are the weird universes beyond frames? Where are the like commander card set symbols? Where's the Modern Horizons stuff? Because those are very often going to be just the best cards in the cube.
That's what I wanted to ask. So like, is there a way from Cube Cobra for you to sort by set, or are you're literally just look like, I'm going to do a quick scan of set symbols and see if anything stands out?
I usually just do a quick scan. Cube Cobra has really robust filtering and sorting options. You absolutely can just sort by set. So you can basically have it, so it'll arrange it in columns by the actual set the card was printed in. Okay. It doesn't always work because it's just whatever version the cube designer happens to have chosen in the cube, which may or may not, you know, depending on where the card was first printed, make any sense. But I usually just kind of do it visually. And again, the cards I'm looking for here are like the really kind of messed up commander or like supplemental set cards. The other sort of category that is a really big sort of red flag to me, or a really big sort of look at me, this is really important, is conspiracies, which are a great example of cards that often end up in cubes. People will put conspiracies in cubes because they're cool cards and they want to play with them, and you can't play with them literally anywhere else. That's the whole thing with conspiracies. They're not legal in any constructed format, including Commander, so they're just like 10-cent cards no one wants unless you're putting them in your cube. And conspiracies are utterly broken. They're just so broken. And maybe people, just to be clear, there's two conspiracy sets. It was a product Wizards of the Coast made that was meant to be drafted with four players and played in a a 1-4-player game fashion, basically. So like politics were meant to matter in both the conspiracy sets. And importantly, it was designed for a 4-player draft, and then you just played one game. That was it. That's the end of your conspiracy draft, which meant that if you had like a really busted card, okay, you won a game, or you have three players now that can team up against you because you have one really broken card. So the sort of knobs that the design team had to sort of adjust were, they had way more leeway than a normal set. And so a lot of the cards are designed basically to start in the command zone and just give you some ability, some effect all the time in every single game. And my favorite sort of anecdote for how powerful these things are, some of them are very plainly powerful. There's one that's called, what's the one you can take? You always go first.
Power play. Very good. You are the starting player. That's the full text of the card.
So that's incredible, right? Like just knowing you go first all the time is incredible. There's one that makes your deck size 5 cards smaller. That's incredible. These are just obviously broken things to like have in a game of Magic.
I think the most broken one is just you draw 2 hands and then pick your favorite one every game. And it's
that's not arguing with the most broken conspiracy. There's so many of them. But
like that card, that is more powerful than Black Lotus because you get it every single time. Like imagine how much it impacts your game to mulligan. What if you always got an extra free mulligan? Like that's such a huge impact on your game win percentage. It's insane.
This is what I was going to say though, is cube designers, there are a lot of cube designers that have a lot of reps with conspiracies because they're kind of cool cards to draft in limited. And there's a conspiracy called Sentinel Dispatch, which just says you start the game with a 1/1 artifact creature with Defender in play. That's the whole thing. And every single cube designer that has played with conspiracies at length that I've ever talked to agrees that that is significantly better than Black Lotus. And you're like, well, it's a 1/1 with Defender. How is that better than Black Lotus? And it's like, that's a card that just says you have 8 cards in your opening hand every single game. One of those cards is a Memnite with Defender. And that just does so much. First of all, you're almost never losing to aggro. You get a free 1-power blocker that's going to trade with the first thing they attack with. And you get it every single game. You don't have to draw it. You just get it no matter what. So anyway, I'm not going to go into this like too deep, but like
big power outliers, look for them. And there are some that you might not expect because you're not going to be familiar with them from other formats.
And if you make clips of this for like TikTok or whatever, just clip me saying that Sentinel Dispatch is better than Black Lotus, and you'll get a bunch of people raging in the comments. But it's absolutely true. And if you haven't played a lot of limited with Sentinel Dispatch, you won't believe me. But that's just a sort of anecdote for how good those cards are. And so sometimes they sneak in, and if I see them in the list, I'm like, well, that's what I need to be doing. I must be playing one of these absolutely broken cards.
First of all, I really appreciate you writing the clickbait for me. Second of all, so I want to narrow into what does knowing there are power outliers prior to drafting versus opening up the pack and seeing those power outliers and drafting them. What does knowing about their existence inform you for the draft?
So I think there's the biggest thing that this is going to kind of allude to is like, if you have a bunch of big power outliers, you want to be playing more colors to have access to them. You obviously want to be aware of them so that you can draft them. But to your point about the difference between knowing about them beforehand and knowing about them during the draft. I think that's actually not a huge difference. I mean, for me personally, the kind of research that I would be doing if I was looking at Cube and trying to figure out my strategy before actually opening up packs or doing it literally during drafting is similar. It's the same thing. You're just doing it on hard mode if you're doing it while you're drafting, because you're seeing 15 cards at a time and trying to sense, okay, what's the distribution of power level within this cube? What's the distribution of removal versus threats? What's the distribution of mana fixing? All these things are things you can pick up and understand during the draft. It's just maybe a little bit easier if you spend the time to do it beforehand. But it's fun to do it.
I feel a little differently. This is maybe where we don't agree completely. I think if you look at cards that are on the like conspiracy spectrum of like, these are so much better than everything else in the cube, you can trust that if you were to sit down and watch 12 drafts of that cube and all the matches, many of the games are just going to be decided by those cards. And so knowing ahead of time, this is very likely how I'm going to lose or win, is like a card like this is going to be what's deciding the game, informs a lot for me. It informs things like, how good is Disenchant here? Am I main decking Disenchant in this cube? And if I see 6 or 7 artifacts or enchantments that just seem like, well, these are all unbeatable in this sort of context based on this list I'm looking at, or at least my impression of them is that they're so much better than everything else, then I'm absolutely taking Disenchant highly and I'm main decking it, right? And that's going to affect how I draft at the very beginning. It also does affect the kind of strategy I want to be doing. If I see some of these really spiky, you know, over the top power level cards, I don't just want to be sitting down and drafting like a 2-color deck in like one of the themes the designer has laid out for me, right? Like, oh, here's the blue red spellslinger deck and somebody's doing some like just playing the One Ring over there. I'm like, well, I want to be playing the One Ring. I don't want to be like trying to ping you to death with like Gutter Snipe. Like that's not like, it helps me understand what the, yeah, what the sort of expectations for like how games are going to go is. And it means that like, I'm not going to try and do something more fair. Even if I don't get the most powerful cards, I might be trying to play a control deck so I can stop my opponents from doing the powerful thing rather than just like doing some mid-rangey thing myself and hoping it's good enough. Whereas if we like take a average, you know, Pauper or Peasant cube, especially one that's kind of optimized for power level or where they're playing the most powerful commons or uncommons, those cubes rarely have these kinds of power outliers because they tend to all be at rare. And so the spikes there are much smaller. And so in a cube like that, I'm so happy to just play 2-for-1s, right? I just want a Gravedigger so that I can, you know, generate card advantage and like kind of do this very fair strategy. I don't want to be doing that if there's a cube where there's like these really powerful, insane, off the rails things.
You talking about, do I main deck Disenchant or maybe I'll draft something controlling to stop it, makes a lot of sense to me in terms of the difference between knowing those cards exist when prior to drafting versus seeing them in the draft, because there are versions of the draft. Let's say there's only a dozen of those cards in the cube that you recognize as power outliers. There's a chance you don't see any of those in the draft. And so you may be going about your day, ho-hum, drafting whatever sort of normal, streamlined, 2-color prescribed deck that the designer intended for you to draft there. And then you get slammed by some Warhammer card in match one and you go, oh, if I had known that, I might have approached, if I had known that that was on the table for anybody, I might have approached this draft differently so that I could have, you know, mitigated my losses to this kind of card.
Yeah, you get to the end of drafting and you start building your deck and you're laying your cards out. You see the person to your right has 2 conspiracies. You didn't know there were any in the cube. You're like, I didn't realize I was in this like hall of like insane mirrors or whatever. I thought I was playing Magic. And so it turns out I'm doing something much crazier.
I mean, that is one of the big challenges, I think, with Cube is when you're playing Retail Limited, especially a set that you've played a few times, you get to the end of the draft and you know, did you draft a good version of the kind of deck you played? Or like you have some sense of how you feel about your deck. And often in a Cube, if you're playing it for the first time, it could just be like, well, I have these cards. They like, I understand how they will play together and what my like goal is, what my game plan is, but I don't know what I'm going to be faced against. And I've been on both sides of that experience of just playing against somebody and saying like, we were not drafting the same cube. Like, all of your cards are better than all of my cards or vice versa.
Which can definitely happen, especially if you like are kind of married to the, what I believe is still the inherited wisdom of Retail Limited, which is that mostly you're going to play a 2-color deck and there's going to be like a 2-color archetype and there'll be a like uncommon gold card that's a signpost. A lot of cubes do follow that pattern. And that's where you're most likely to get to the end of the draft and play your first opponent and be like, oh, we're not even in the same stratosphere of power level, because turns out that this cube designer just actually really loves blue-red spells and really does not like green-black midrange. And so if I just take the green-black midrange cards and assume that, you know, this was designed such that all 10 color pairs are like within, you know, spitting distance of each other, you might get to the end and find out that is not the case even at all. And so yeah, that's kind of an important thing I think to try and wrap your head around.
I mean, maybe the way that I would describe that difference is I approach a cube draft with a lot of skepticism, and whether that's me like reading the overview and seeing that the cube designer said like, oh yeah, green black is all about this strategy and blue white's all about this strategy. I think that like in most limited formats, you can kind of trust that they're going to be reasonably on the same page. And if you are drafting one of those archetypes that's sort of prescriptive, you're at least going to be engaging on somewhat the same level as other people in the pod. If I see some like clear signpost that says like screams draft plus one counters around me, I'm still going to have a healthy dose of skepticism
for sure,
because I don't know that this cube designer, you know, they don't have the resources of Wizards of the Coast behind them to make sure that that plus one counters archetype is equally balanced against everything else. So I might still draft it if I can see that there's like a reasonable floor on the card, or, you know, we're in pack two and I've seen enough to get the sense that like, okay, there is enough support for this. But I will approach it with a lot of skepticism and not assume that whatever support a card hints at or implies is definitely going to be there.
But I think your question is really good, Ethan, because I think there's actually kind of two slightly different things that are worth disambiguating here, because I definitely do look for things like conspiracies or like other kind of more game warping cards before the draft. And that will totally affect my, like, how I go in blind. Right.
I mean, do you think that's something that comes up pretty frequently? I feel like that's fairly rare in my cube experience.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, it's notable when it happens.
Well, but what I was going to say, though, is that I think the sort of looking at supplemental sent cards, that's very much a like middle of the draft thing. I'm looking at a pack. Here's, you know, six cards I know and seven cards I've never, ever seen before. Which ones am I going to read? Which ones am I actually spend the time to read all the text on them? And that's where I'm like, OK, this is in a UB frame. I am going to like read this twice and make sure I understand it because it's probably messed up. Or this is a crazy, really complicated set symbol I don't recognize. It's probably some weird commander product. Let me like really do my due diligence on this card to make sure that I understand what it's doing, because it might be totally cracked. Because it is harder to do that looking at the whole cube.
Sure.
A priori. So I don't know about you, Anthony. For me, the next thing I do when I'm looking at a cube is, this is again where I feel like I have a little bit of license being on your show and not my show. I can say that I think a lot of cube designers miss their design goals and end up with a cube where a 3, 4, 5 color sort of good stuffy deck is way better than they intend. Like I mentioned, I think a lot of cube designers kind of set out to design a cube the way that Wizards of the Coast designs most retail limited sets, which is to say we've got 10 2-color pairs. They've each got some kind of theme. Let's make sure that, you know, whatever color combination you're drafting, your deck is viable. And what they actually end up with is a cube where one of the best things to do is just to take as many fixing lands as you can and then take every single gold card that wheels to you, and your deck is going to be kind of cracked just on raw card quality. And this happens a lot because, frankly, I think gold cards are cool. Magic players like gold cards. They want to put them in their cubes. And because they're cool, a lot of cubes end up with a much higher density of gold cards than you would ever see in a retail limited set, unless it was like a gold specific, you know, themed set. So if you just look at a random cube list and you see 60, 70, 80 gold cards, that's a ton of gold cards to be going around the table. And if you're only drafting with 8 players, and some of those players are assuming this sort of, you know, 2-color archetype, you know, baseline, then you're going to have, first of all, 2 whole archetypes that aren't even drafted at all. Well, 3 if you don't count yourself, right? So you got 7 other players. Let's assume they're all in some 2-color combination with no overlap, which is rare. That means there's 3 guilds that all those gold cards are just going to wheel to you late. No one ever wants any of those cards because they're not playing those color combinations. Plus, you get the chance to snipe the best gold cards from the one player that is playing blue-white across the table from them, because you're going to get to see those cards sometimes before they get to see them. And yeah, in these cubes, I think 5-color good stuff is very often, in a lot of cubes, a really, really good deck. And it's just trying to figure out how good that deck is really complicated just at a glance, right? It's how viable that deck is in a cube is like a factor of so many things. And what I look for is, number one, just the number of gold cards, the raw number of them. Again, if there's a lot of them, that just means there's going to be a lot of otherwise really strong cards that will go much later in the draft than you would otherwise expect, right? If you took the mana cost away and just looked at the rules text, you'd be like, well, this is a great card. This is a B+ or an A-. I would never expect to wheel this or get it past pick 6. But if it's a gold card, you will. You will get it super late. And so knowing that, you can go into the draft and you can say, all right, well, first of all, I'm just going to take any huge bombs, right? If there's anything that's like an A++, you know, maybe a mistake to include in the cube, some huge power outlier in any color, literally any color, you just take that. That's your sort of first pick order thing. After that, you just take fixing lands or other mana fixing if it exists, things that make treasures or, you know, mana rocks. But you just take fixing over what are otherwise a pack full of Bs, you know, a pack full of like B cards across all the colors. You just take the fixing land, even if it's a bad fixing land. And you do that in the first couple packs, and then you find that at the end of the pack, you're just wheeling, again, like B-minus gold cards, like really great removal spells, whatever. And then you find that you can put together this deck that just, I think, very often plays like a tap-out control deck, which is to say that you have inevitability on your side, but you don't have like a draw-go sort of very focused deck where your whole thing is like counter magic and board wipes. You're just playing threats, and your threats are better than your opponents, and eventually you'll grind them out with card advantage. You can't draft an aggressive deck this way, I should say, because you're going to be across so many colors. It's going to take you a little time to get your mana under yourself. But if you do just have better card quality than your opponents, you can expect to win a long game. And so the third thing I prioritize is just any 2-for-1s. Doesn't matter what it is. Like Pilgrim's Eye is in a lot of cubes, especially like rarity restricted cubes. And Pilgrim's Eye is so good in this deck. It's just like, yeah, great. Let me fix my mana in my deck that is otherwise pretty greedy and also put a 1-1 flyer in play to, you know, hopefully trade with one of your attackers or just chump block and buy time or be there for me to sacrifice to a Village Rites or whatever. That sort of baseline is like when you're taking Pilgrim's Eye over like a splashy 5-drop that is like would have been the best rare in its retail limited set, that's when you know that you're, you know, drafting your 5-color good stuff cube. The one other thing to look out for here is just, I think the way to actually keep this deck in check, if you're a cube designer, is making sure aggro is really good and you just can't afford to, you know, maybe wait an extra turn to cast your spells because your fixing land comes into play tapped or because you had to use your Pilgrim's Eye to find your red source. Now you're casting your red 3-drop on turn 4 instead of turn 3. And if there's an environment where decks can really punish that, that's the way to keep that in check. So after looking at all the gold cards, just how many are there, I will just try and get a sense for how fast I expect the most aggressive deck in the format to be. And my go-to shorthand for that is just how many 1-drops are in white and red, 1-drop creatures specifically. And if I see a lot, and by a lot, I mean, I'll say per 360 cards, you know, cubes are all different sizes, but in most cases, you're trying to draft with 8 players. And so that requires 360 cards and normal pack sizes. So per 360 cards, if I'm seeing like 10 to 12 1-drop creatures in white and red, that's a high density. That's where I'm like, all right, my opponent is very likely going to be able to play a threat on turn 1, and then on turn 2, either play another threat or 2 more threats, and then just really put the pressure on. If you're seeing 4 to 6 one drops in those colors, it's just not possible that your aggro opponents are going to reliably be able to do that. And then you can start taking the Pilgrim's Eye, grind them out 5-color nonsense strategy, which I think is very successful in a lot of cubes.
So three elements here that I'm hearing. One is density of gold cards, density of fixing, maybe lands, but also things like Pilgrim's Eye, things that are, you know, 2-for-1 fixing properties like that. And the third is how likely is this strategy going to fall to an aggressive deck?
Yeah, I mean, I agree on some of these key components. And definitely if I'm going to preview a list before a draft, I'm also looking at like, what do I expect the fastest deck to look like in this cube? Because that is a huge, like, everything kind of shakes out, the whole meta shakes out from what is the fastest that you need to like have your defenses up, and whether that means you want to try and be that fastest deck or be prepared for it, like you have to be one of those two. So it's important either way, and I agree that mana fixing is critical, and that's going to both inform just how highly I'm going to take it, because I always mana fixing is really good. Like, you're drafting 45 cards usually, you don't need 45 playables in terms of, you know, cards that do stuff, unless it's fixing your mana. Like, you just get more by drafting those lands. Where I digress from your approach, Andy, is I don't necessarily think about that like 5-color deck as much for a couple reasons. One is I think that cube has changed a lot in the last couple years, and honestly I think that we can take some of the blame / credit for that. But I know we and many other cube designers have advocated for new people that are building cubes to play fewer gold cards, because I always end up in sideboards or end up with this happening, and play more lands because consistent mana bases makes for fun games, and drafting lands is fun. So I don't think it's quite as viable in general. I also just don't have as much success with that kind of deck. And I think that there's something implicit in everything that we're both saying, is that like at some level you got to know which cards are good and which cards are bad, and how to choose the right ones to take. And like, sure, it all boils down to take the good cards. I don't have the card evaluation skills that, let's say, Sam Black has to be able to look at any random cube and just know that, oh yeah, that gold card is busted, so I'm definitely going to take that and then take whatever fixing I can and just play only those busted cards.
This is somewhat famously what Sam Black does to almost every cube at KubeCon every year, and almost always has a near perfect record. Now, again, this is kind of like the LSV thing of like, yeah, Sam Black does pretty good at that because he's Sam Black. Like, he's going to pilot the deck immaculately after drafting it. You could follow his, like, you know, draft process and do terribly if you're a lesser player.
Yeah. So I know that for my, like, my level of skill and my knowledge of cards, I'm going to have a lot more success. Yeah, kind of like sticking with that two colors as a baseline. And I'm absolutely going to digress from that if I see an individual card that is splashable or that makes sense. Or if I do end up just with like a lot of incidental fixing, because I will take fixing highly, then I will end up splashing, playing more colors or focusing on like being base one color. But my assumption is not that I can personally have success with a five color control deck. I don't know when the last time I put a Pilgrim's Eye in a deck was, and I just had to go check and make sure it is in my own cube.
Well, your cube is one where I don't think this is actually viable for all the reasons we talked about, but yeah, I think actually fixing is an important thing to touch on, because this is actually one of the places I think we can say fairly universally this is where Cube is different from Retail Limited.
For sure.
And Retail Limited, your mana is just awful. I'm sorry, Retail Limited players, but your mana sucks. It is we know. Such a bummer.
We know. Yeah, it's bad.
And again, this is, I think, goes back to my point earlier about the fact that Wizards of the Coast has a lot of things they have to take into consideration when they put 15 cards in a booster pack. And one of those things is, if you're a 7-year-old buying your first Magic pack and it opened it, and you've got 7 lands in it, you're pretty bummed. Lands are not that exciting to you when you are new to the game. You want dragons and creatures and spells.
They tried that. That's what Alpha looked like.
Well, yeah. Meanwhile, I think for Cube, 7 lands is great. That's exactly what you want to see. Because like Anthony said, you know, you have 45 picks. You need 23, 24, 25 playable non-land cards. The rest of your picks, the other 20 picks you're making, are wasted if they are not making your deck. And so taking a card that's going to make your deck over a card that will be in your sideboard, or replace a card that's slightly worse than it in your sideboard, is a lot of, you know, high value to taking mana fixing in cube drafts. And something I tell new cube drafters a lot when I'm trying to explain the values of mana fixing is just to kind of, if you're, you know, drafting and let's say you're committed to like a red green after pack one, I'm a red green deck, and you know, late pack one you see like a bomb blue green gold card, right? Like, let's just say for some whatever reason it happens, you wheel after impact one, Oko is still in the pack and you're red green. Like, of course you're taking Oko. Everyone knows you take Oko there, and you figure out some way to splash it. And my argument to them is that you should look at Breeding Pool almost exactly the same way. Like, Breeding Pool is a really good gold card. It's a really good green blue gold card. If you're in one of those colors and you see that late, absolutely take it. Like, take that over that like very middling card that's on color that you kind of don't think is going to be the best, or it might end up being your 24th or 25th or 26th card. Take that fixing land, because that means that in the future, when you open one of these other cards that is the gold card that's really appealing, then you can actually cast it. And I think just the fact that there's going to be way more mana fixing in almost every cube than any Retail Limited set does change how you draft. And you should basically be preparing in almost every cube to be closer to a constructed level mana base than a limited mana base, you know, obviously somewhere in between. We're not getting all the way constructed sort of standards, but closer to it, certainly. If I come out of a cube draft and I only have 4 dual lands, I'm pretty unhappy. I feel like I did a bad job if I have 4 fixing lands in my deck. Whereas I know for Retail Limited, that would be like a godsend for most decks. So the one other thing I want to say about that too is this is maybe my hottest take that I'll mention on this episode, even hotter than Sentinel Dispatch is better than Black Lotus, which is, I actually think the like quantity of fixing lands in a cube for me is a pretty minor impact on how good I think this 3-4 color, you know, good stuff deck is.
Okay.
A lot of players are like, well, if there's a bunch of lands, then I can beat that deck really easily. And it certainly helps. But again, even low land count cubes will have like, I don't know, let's say that like a 360 card cube, a really low fixing count for me would be like 30. Like if you only have 3 land cycles in a 360 card cube, my main like power motivated cube, I think, has 85 lands in it right now at 360. So whoa. 30 for me is really low. I'm like not happy with that. I think 60 is around normal and what you should expect. But even with 30 fixing lands, I will still be very happy to play a 3-4-5 color deck in that cube if those other factors are in line. If the gold cards are numerous and powerful, and if there's not an obvious aggro deck that I'm worried about just like getting under me, I'm still very happy to take whatever fixing lands I see, and again, take them even higher because there's fewer of them, but you still with 30 fixing lands, you know, the average player is going to have four in their deck, right? Basically, you can very easily, by taking more than average, end up with eight or nine. And once you have nine fixing lands across a three or four color deck, you're fine. You're good. You're golden. You did it. So this is like one of my hot takes. I just think that like, you don't need a ton of fixing to make the five color deck good. You just need good gold cards and medium to bad aggro decks.
So let's say that you're drafting a cube that doesn't fall into some of these pitfalls. The power level is flat. There are no egregious outliers. The gold cards are not super plentiful. They're sparing or maybe non-existent. So you don't have those couple of categories to fall back on. What are you mining the cube list for then? Or what are you setting yourself up mentally to do when you open your first pack?
If I look at the list and I don't see any of these like huge red flag power cards, and I don't see like too many gold cards, and I don't see a lack of aggro strategies, I'm honestly at that point just like really pumped. I'm really pumped to go in blind and just be like, all right, I actually can just look at a pack now and kind of follow my nose and maybe have success, right? Really what I'm trying to suss out when I look at these things ahead of time is like, will I be deceived? Like Anthony mentioned with skepticism earlier.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Seeing some card and being like, oh, well, this suggests this deck is viable. Maybe it is. These are the main things that would basically mean that that card is kind of lying to you. That actually, you know, that deck is not viable. What you should be doing is just be playing four to five color control, or you should just be trying to play a conspiracy, or just trying to play hard control to stop all these broken things that are otherwise happening. If none of those things are true, then I think I'd be maybe more things you look at that point ahead of the list, Anthony. But for me, I'm just excited to kind of look at a pack and see what jumps out to me here. Like based on these 15 cards, this 15 card sample of this environment, if I assume these cards are mutually playable, which of these things do I think I want to be doing and kind of operating on a more micro scale? And then it really does become a sort of question of card valuation. And then you get into like, you know, once the draft is going, then there's all these other, you know, questions of like, what should your curve look like? And I know that I, as a player, I lean towards having excellent fixing, which might be obvious already to your listeners. Like I will take lands very, very highly over anything that I expect to be in, let's say, the bottom half of my playables. Like anything that's like top, you know, 10 or 12 playables, I think one of the best 10 or 12 cards in my deck, I'll take that over a fixing land. But anything below that is always a fixing land first, no matter what. And I'll take fixing even higher. Like a fetch land for me is like one of the best cards in my deck already. So I'd say fixing really highly. I also love playing a low curve, especially in cubes where the cards are mutually playable. I think you just want to be casting more spells than your opponent in a lot of situations. And so even in that 3 to 4 color control deck I mentioned, like I still prioritize a really low curve where I can. Like I want Baleful Strix and Pilgrim's Eye and Kolgan's Command and whatever. I don't want to be playing like Cruel Ultimatum. Like maybe if I wheel it, that could be like the payoff. But I just want to be like chaining together little dinky spells that overwhelm my opponent.
You're lying. You love to put Cruel Ultimatum in your deck.
I mean, when it's right, I love to. Yeah, everyone loves to cast Cruel Ultimatum, but it's not what I'm looking to do generally. And so, do you have anything else that you look at, Anthony, like before you've sat down to draft to like figure out if you're going to be deceived by the cards in the packs?
No, I mean, I think I agree that when you don't have these obvious, this sounds too negative, but like I think the word I want to use is exploits or exploitable features. When you don't have those, you really do just get to fall back on limited fundamentals. And I think that at that point for me, it's kind of about evaluating what is the rate in this cube. So by rate, I mean like, okay, like a normal card would be a 2-mana 2/2 creature with a little bit of upside. And then trying to like evaluate all of my cards around that, what I'm perceiving to be the rate. So is this a above average card or is this a worse card in this particular environment? And I think you had this sort of idea of if you could sort of like assign an abstract power level number that you were calling, what was it, the blackjack theory to try and quantify your decks. And I think that's exactly the way that I kind of try to think about the cards in my deck, where it's like, okay, this card has a particular rate and that rate is going to go up or down depending on the cards around it. And some cards will have a very narrow distance between their floor and ceiling, and some will be very broad. And so I'm really focusing on initially, are there cards that have that very narrow or that very high floor that you don't need to necessarily build around them a lot? And then once I start getting more support cards, things that are going to turn my cards that would have been C's into B's and my B's into A's, then I'll lean more on those. But yeah, definitely trying to get the fixing before I take the cards that I'm splashing, get the enablers before I take the but it's always a balance. It's like, okay, here's a card that I know has like a huge, huge ceiling. Like, is it worth that risk? And just navigating those like little risks in every pick that's what cube drafting is all about.
Yeah. One thing that's really important is I think a really good cube will often cater to like kind of whatever you like to do in Magic, in a certain context, obviously. But I think if you are sitting down at a really good cube and, you know, like all these sort of exploits we've mentioned are like not present, or as far as you could tell, they're not present from looking at the list, then if you love playing blue-red spells, or you love playing, you know, whatever, if you look at that first pack and you see Young Pyromancer and you're like, I'm a Young Pyromancer gamer, then there's a very good chance, you know, if that cube is well designed, you can do the Young Pyromancer thing. And so you can kind of...
Maybe. I don't know. Be skeptical.
My skepticism... I guess it depends on what you're into, right? If what you're really into is like extremely narrow, this card does nothing until I have the second part that pairs with it, then like that stuff is generally harder. You can get a really long way in these events just by playing cards with a high floor and like good fundamentals, like a good curve, cards with a high floor. A lot of people are going to be, frankly, just kind of, they're going to be drawn in by an ambitious, cool thing that is actually not that good, right? Seven drops are really hard to cast in any environment. And so it's a really cool seven drop, but if you are just playing a good curve and, you know, have a deck with a little bit of disruption and whatever card advantage, you'll be fine. But really, I think the most important thing is just compared to retail limited, I think you need to make a plan. And the drafts I've had that have been most successful in are ones where I either before from looking at the list, just perusing it in the 5 minutes while we were shuffling up, or in the first, you know, call it 4 to 6 picks, I settled on a plan where I was like, okay, whether it's right or wrong, I'm going to like, here's what I'm going to like have a thesis about what I think is going to be good here. And I'm going to commit to that thesis. I'm going to like believe in myself more than the cube designer. Right. And that might be that. Yeah. You know, I see Young Pyromancer in a cube that is like an otherwise very like fair creature combat, like low power cube. But I'm like, well, might be hard to like chain together one mana cantrips of this cube because that's probably not what it's about. But also see that like there's very few cards in this pack that allow me to put multiple game objects into play for one card. And Young Pyromancer allows for an indefinite number of card objects given a long enough game. And so that's a really high ceiling. And I'm going to like try and make that card really good and like see how that pans out. Having that sort of plan, I think, informs your picks. Whereas the easiest way for me, at least, to train wreck a draft is if I just don't really make up my mind. And, you know, I am like the first part of the pack, I'm doing this. And then I'm like, oh, but that seems really good. And then I end up just kind of like somewhere in between, or I don't have a plan and I just take good cards, right? And this is, I think, pretty well-trod territory about the Vintage Cube, right? There's a joke, at least from years and years ago, that, you know, the first time anybody drafts the Vintage Cube, they sit down and they draft green, black, mid-range, and they're like, I have 6 Planeswalkers. I can't possibly lose. These cards are all broken. And then they realize that, like, you just don't play mid-range in that cube. Like, or if you do play mid-range, it has to be a very specific brand of, like, disruptive kind of hate-berry mid-range or whatever is viable in the cube these days. But like, that's just not really a thing, right? And so if you just sit down and take good cards and don't like have a plan, or at least make a plan in somewhere in the middle of that first pack, that for me is at least how I always, you know, run awry. Where I think back to my run at Boston Cube Party, I remember from doing our like recap episode, that whole weekend, for whatever it was, my attitude was like, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to look at this list in the first 5 minutes, and I'm just going to like pick a thing, right? And I remember looking at like the Dominaria Invasion Reimagined cube and being like, this is a 5-color good stuff cube. And I sat down and was just like, I'm just doing it. Like, I looked at it, there were so many gold cards, the cards were all low power level, and I was like, I'm just taking fixing lands and I'm going to play as few duds as I possibly can in this cube. And I had success doing that. I remember playing the, I'm going to forget all the cube names, but there was a Ixalan through some other, it was like a standard cube, but for like a particular block of standard. And in that one, I sat down and looked at it and I was like, I feel like mid-range is just gonna be great here. Like, control seems so bad. Like, it just, there's not like board wipes and there's like almost no counter magic. I was like, my 4 and 5 drops are just gonna resolve. Like, I don't see how I lose if I just have like good 4 and 5 drops and just get to cast them. And so I just did that. And like, just coming up with an idea like that, I think is kind of, for me, how I have success. It's just like, you got to have a plan and then try it. And sometimes you fail, right? And like, that's just, to me, that's part of the joy of it though. And I can understand how maybe for your audience, it's like, no, my whole point is I want to win at all costs. That's what I care about. Like, spiking this draft is what's most important to me. And I think for you, it's like, do your homework if you want. Like, if that's really like what you care about, then like, look at all the cube lists ahead of time. You're going to go to some cube event, or like, if you're going to draft a cube for the first time online. Something I want people to know is that on Cube Cobra, you can simulate drafts. You can go to any cube list and you can draft against their bots, which are pretty good as long as you're not in one of these zany cubes where the card evaluation is totally recontextualized and the bots don't know that.
You said zany. I want to make sure we talk about some zany cubes. I want to talk about approaching, and maybe it's just a broad umbrella and all of these kinds of cubes go into it, but you know, 100 Ornithopters, maybe Turbo Cube, certainly the cubes I mentioned, like Companion Cube or Igonjo Drift, like these cubes where there are radical desert cubes. I don't know if these fall under the category as well.
But definitely.
For sure.
So, I mean, obviously, once you've drafted a desert cube a handful of times, like you'll obviously adopt some sort of heuristics, but let's say I personally, Ethan, have never drafted a desert cube. So what would you tell someone, or how would I go about approaching something like that? Or when you see for the first time, maybe this happened to you in one of your recent events, you sat down and, okay, here's a rules change for this cube that you then had to on the fly try and contextualize. I'd love to hear how you went about doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way to succeed at those really crazy cubes, like we're talking about the Turbo Cube or the Cascade Cube, is just to go into it with the right expectations so you don't come out of it having a terrible time and just know that you're not going to do great the first time and you're going to have to do it once or twice to get your feet under you. I don't think there is.
Some people do.
Some people do.
You and I don't, but some people do. Some people
That's
are
true.
Like,
there's particular.
There's a certain type of Magic player, and there's players, I guess, in our play group that are just, that's what they love about the game. They love like really thinking deeply about specific card interactions and like weird combos. Like they're like, you know, Johnny's, I guess, is how you do Johnny Jenny's, I guess, is the sort of macro archetype. But I put in my notes that like, if truly like winning is your goal and you're going to have more fun if you win and less fun if you lose and you have an option, just don't draft these cubes. Like the first time you are very likely to train wreck, because like you said, you have the experience you had, Ethan, of getting halfway through match one and being like, okay, let's go again. I'm ready. I'm done with this deck. I've had my fun. Time to go and like, do this again, because now I understand what I'm actually doing. That's very likely to happen in these zany cubes. You just kind of got to accept that and come in with the right attitude.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a universal shortcut. It's just, do you have experience with whatever the particular mechanic rules modification is? If not, you're kind of going to have to learn. I mean, if you do, there are like case by case things that you can learn about and sort of exploit. Like if you're familiar with the Cascade Cube, where the first spell you cast each turn has Cascade, if you have played Cascade and Constructed, you'll know like, okay, I want to make sure I have like a broken zero drop, and then all of my one drops can cascade into it. And so that's
not what Cascade does in Constructive.
I don't know what Cascade does in Constructive.
They just put rhinos into play.
Yeah, sure. That's what I mean. Yeah, you have your broken zero drop, which is rhinos.
I see. Yeah. I'm confused. That's a no drop. There's no mana cost at all. I'm too pilled thinking.
You're too
of,
broken. Or the Turbo Cube. It's like, there's.
Well, maybe I have a thesis now, just coming to my head right now, which is that I think you should, if you're in one of these context shift cubes, really prioritize the cards that gain the most from the context shift.
Sure. Yeah.
This is what we describe about the Turbo Cube a lot to people, is like,
in this cube, I should say, all spells and activated abilities cost 2 generic mana less.
Yes,
other than that, totally normal magic.
And
good, clean fun.
Yeah, I think maybe your first thesis about this, and a lot of people's first ideas, was like, oh, well, now I can cast a 4-drop on turn 2. There's got to be a bunch of really good 4-drops. And it's like, that's cool. You know what's cooler? Casting 17 2-drops on turn 1, because they all cost 0, right? And so looking at that cube, like, we always tell new drafters, like, all right, it's going to be kind of crazy. Like, you know, be ready for some nonsense. Also, like, take a second look at every single card in the pack that you can cast for 0 mana. Like, whatever it is. Just like, you've probably never read Sin and Sanctum before. Read Sin and Sanctum again and just tell yourself, this is free. This costs no mana at all. And so I think that's also true of the Cascade Cube, right? Like, okay, what spells benefit the most from the fact that now every spell is Cascade? These pitch spells are now kind of messed up, right? And so, like, trying to just look at the cards that are benefiting the most from that context shift is maybe the sort of first clue for like how to get footing in an environment that is otherwise weird.
Yeah.
And cards that are otherwise generically good. Like you have Oko in the Turbo Cube really as a trap, I would say. Like it's a joke.
It's a benchmark to illustrate how
the joke is Oko sucks in the Turbo Cube. It's so bad. And it's just funny that like, yeah, if you go into that cube without thinking hard about the you know, actual rules modification, you won't realize that Sin and Sanctum is 2 tiers better than Oko in that cube. And so you should just avoid, you should like basically try and rid yourself of any biases you have that you've inherited from other magic contexts, and try as much as possible to be a blank slate and let the cube wash over you.
And be prepared to leave with new biases that will haunt you and not make sense in other places. You'll see Guild Globe and just start tingling.
I was drafting the stupid Spider-Man set for like, I don't know, 6 days. And then I was like, all right, I think I'm going to go switch over and I'll they brought back Final Fantasy. So I drafted that and I was looking, I was like, okay, so which two cards am I going to take out of this pack? And I was like, already broken from these few days of doing this other format. Yeah. Yeah.
To go back to Desert Cubes really quick, though, because I think that those are, they're sort of in this category of a very novel experience if you've never done it. So Desert Cube, you have no access to basic lands, or there's, you know, everything is a spectrum. There's all kinds of cubes. But generally, you draft your basic lands in addition to everything else. And on one hand, that is a big context shift. And it's huge that you can end up with just a unplayable deck. You can literally just be like, well, I have my 9 lands. Good luck to me.
And they're the wrong color.
And they're the wrong color. Oops. So there is a shift. In another way, though, they almost feel more like just like hardcore draft fundamentals. And the thing that I feel whenever I'm drafting a Desert Cube is I need to pace myself. I need to make sure at the end of pack 3, I have a third of the lands that I want. And
at the end of pack 3, you want all the lands you want.
Sorry? At the end of pack... and then also two more thirds of the lands that I want. I was not finished with my sentence.
Got them.
At the end of pack 1, have a third of them. And yeah, it's always going to be a little bit wonky. It's not like every third pick is going to be a land, but just like figure out a pace yourself.
See, and my approach to Desert Cube is slightly different. I want at least half of my lands out of pack 1.
Sure.
I'm not joking. Like,
I think that's fair.
My number one tip to people drafting Desert Cubes is basic lands are so good.
They're really good.
You've always had them for free, so you don't realize how good they are. They are so good. It isn't. This land taps for blue and comes in untapped. That's incredible in most Desert Cubes.
Can't be wastelanded.
Yeah, it can't be wastelanded.
Really
so,
powerful.
That's a very detailed thing about Desert Cubes, but I actually agree. I think your sort of assessment is really cool. They are like drafting like fundamentals hard mode where it's like you always have to think about, okay, what's my density of threats versus interaction,
exactly,
or like what does my curve look like, but now you also just throw your basic lands into it too. Like, you also need to think about drafting your ways. You got to draft your holistic deck with every pick, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and I think that's where I feel like I can sort of learn lessons as well, where it's like, oh yeah, if I'm at the end of pack 1 and I have no removal, it's probably time to start thinking about that and make sure I resolve that in pack 2. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's also this whole thing that's coming to mind of like, do you have goals for your next pack? I feel like that's something that I'm often thinking about, is like, I see that there are holes in my deck, and like pack 3, I'm taking a certain type of fixing land that like makes my fetches work, or I'm taking that removal spell over anything else, and sort of, yeah, figuring out how to pace yourself and make sure you're getting all the ingredients that you need for your deck is something that I'm always thinking about.
Well, and this is loops back to what I was mentioning at the top of the episode or of the interview, is that I think that Cube teaches you those things in such a heightened or exacerbated way, because I do the same thing when I'm drafting a regular set of like, okay, I have benchmarks of I'd like to have about 7 or 8 playables by the end of pack 1. So can I have 15 by the end of pack 2 and have my 23 by the end of pack 3? And that lets me know when I can take fixing. And I remember like learning about like why taking lands was powerful in Cube. Like, that's a really, for me at least, that felt like a hard lesson to internalize of like, you get power from being able to play more draft picks in your deck, full stop. And then you're just like taking that to the extreme. It's like, oh, you like taking lands? How do you like taking a swamp as your draft pick out of a pack?
I like it a lot in a Desert Cube.
Right.
I first pick basic lands all the time in Desert Cubes, and I feel great about it. It's like, you just have to think about it as a really good red card. A mountain is just a really good red card. And so you think about it that way and just kind of, yeah, it changes your framing, I think, a lot. There's a cube I really love, which is kind of in this space, which I think is interesting. It's even to a further extreme, I think. A friend of ours, Jane, has a cube called the Ball Pit, where you draft and just play your entire pool. There's no deck building and there's no basic box. You'd have to play every single card you draft, which means that last pick you got, you absolutely have to play it. It all goes in your deck.
And it is a Desert Cube too, right? So you have to draft all your lands.
Yeah.
And if you draft too many lands, well, there's a solution.
Well, the solution is that in this cube, you can play any card face down as a Chromatic Sphere, which means that, okay, you got that triple black spell last in your like green-white deck. That's just a Chromatic Sphere. You have a Chromatic Sphere now, and you have to play it in your deck. And that's another example of like, yeah, how do you evaluate cards in that cube? I've played it once, and it was fascinating. That was actually a great example of me coming in with a thesis. In that cube, there's a lot of broken singleton. There's cards that are in there in 4s or 10s or, you know, I think there's 16 copies of Mirror Enforcer in that cube right now.
Sounds right.
I remember you talking about this in the episode. This is the one with the locust Cloud lands.
Coast. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The loci. After talking about it with a friend, I was just like, you know, being able to make inordinate amounts of colorless mana seems very, very strong in a cube where every single card is a Chromatic Sphere. And also, these Lokai just get better with every one you have. Like, the first one's already a fine pick because you have to draft all your lands. So there's a land. You got one now. And then the second one is a really high pick. And then it just goes up and up and up and up. And so I just sat down and was like, well, here's my strategy. I'm going to draft Lokai and then some payoffs for having arbitrarily amounts of large colorless mana. And it worked fabulously. And I just picked Lokai over everything. And I think to be fair, it's a 60-card format, so you have a 60-card deck and play your entire pool. But I think I had 14 Lokai or lands that could be like a Vesuva or a Thespian Stage, like cards that could also be Lokai in my deck, and it went kind of crazy with it, which I would never have come to that strategy by going pack by pack, right? I had to look at the list ahead of time and see, oh, there are four copies of each of the Lokai, and there's Vesuvas, and there's Thespian Stages. Like, this is a supported thing. Looking at the actual packs, I might have missed the first four until I realized they were in that number to sort of like pick up on that strategy. So another sort of check in the column of like, just have a plan, just like have a thesis and test it and try to like see you're playing the cube as like partially an experiment. And like, is this thesis correct or not? You know?
Yeah, I really like the sort of idea. It helps me for there being kind of like two buckets of like, okay, check these kinds of, well, maybe the two buckets are, is there just a radical rules shift to the cube? And if there is, instead of looking at individual cards, just try and spend the 5 or 10 minutes before you're going to draft it, wrapping your head around like what that shift means in the abstract. I think like if I think of those kinds of cubes that I've drafted where you start with a land in play and okay, what does that mean in terms of how I value two drops? Or I know there's a lot of discussion around, do you want to be on the play or on the draw with those decks and what your curve looks like to inform that decision and what it means to be able to splash any single pipped planeswalker that you see or whatever. So there's that context. And then there's all of the sort of like great sort of power outlier or fixing or gold card things that you all have been talking about. I do want to ask a question that is off script here. So let me just go there for a second, which is that one of the things that I find very, it's interesting, but it's difficult for me in these cube environments is there's a broad range of opponents you're going to play. You can go from round one in a cube facing someone who is extremely well-versed. Maybe they're even the designer of the cube themselves and you're facing off against them. And then round two, you're playing a less enfranchised player, someone who is maybe even less familiar with the rules than you. And that kind of whiplash of, I don't know, I feel like the kind of player I have to be, whether it's someone who's like really focused and like, okay, I've assessed that you're the kind of player who knows what's up and is really trying to win, so I'm also going to turn that gear on. Or
it's not going to let me go back and hit that trigger that I missed 10 seconds ago and no other game actions have happened, but you said, actually, you already put it in your graveyard, so I think you missed the trigger? Yeah.
Right, so yeah, and what are your social graces? Like, let me assess that, and I'll calibrate my play in that sense. Two, oh, okay, I'm going to need to take care of you, my opponent, in some capacity in this game, which I have no, like, I mean, and maybe you're laughing, and maybe that's not a fair way to assess it. But that's
no, how I wasn't. That's I think how I think very about sweet, it. Honestly, I'm laughing because I think it's very sweet to be like, oh yeah, that's how people should, I think, feel at a competitive Magic event. But it's so rare that people feel that way because
yes. But I also I also don't love that. I find that very difficult to go like
interesting. Yeah.
From like if I'm going to a paper event that is Magic that I paid money to do, I'm gonna try and win and. Mm-hmm. But I am also a human being and I recognize that like, okay, but that's not how you're engaging with the game, or I'm going to need to sort of like taper that kind of spikiness a little bit and sort of, okay, you missed this trigger or you want to do this or be a little bit more patient, whatever that is. I find that aspect of it difficult, but I get a sense from you both, especially with you being so fostering your own cube community where you live is such a big part of your identity of your show and encouraging others to do so. I get the sense you don't have that. And so I'm curious if that's just an innate thing, if that's something you have worked on, or if you think like, wow, this Ethan guy sounds like a real jerk if he can't
just not the
hang
last
with
one.
These people. So I'm
just
curious
about
your
sweet and kind.
Yeah. No, I think it's really important to read the room, and every match is its own little room.
Rooms inside of rooms.
Rooms inside of rooms.
And then you cast
wheels
a room.
Within wheels. To me, that is just a huge priority. Like, we go to a lot of these small events that are, you know, 30, 60, 100 players, and people are there to try new stuff and explore new, weird, wacky environments. And people are also there to win. Like, I think, to go back to what we were saying at the top, like, we are kind of spikes and we want to improve ourselves and we want to play well, because that's really what defines and makes the experience meaningful. Like, the most extreme case in the opposite direction is if somebody's like, oh, I don't know who to attack in a multiplayer format, I'm just going to roll dice to see who I attack. And I'm like,
and that's when I walked away from Commander forever.
If I wanted to play against rolling dice, I could have done that at home.
Yeah.
So it's like, the fact that my opponents are thinking and making decisions and trying to win, and I know that they are trying to win, like, that's important. But I also don't want to win because somebody just, like, miss their trigger because they're playing a deck full of cards they have read only for the first time 15 minutes ago, and they're doing their best. So yeah, I mean, I think it is really important to kind of read where people are at, and I would encourage people at Cube events as much as possible to be patient, remind people of triggers, stuff like that. Like, I think that just really creates a great vibe. But also, it is going to vary opponent to opponent. I mean, you and I were just playing, I was playing somebody against a player that is very skilled, sort of knows the game, yesterday morning, and I go to my turn, draw my card, and he's like, oh shoot, I guess I could have done something. And I'm like, okay, no problem. If you want to roll that back, take your turn, great, I counter that. And it's like, yeah, that would
be
very,
very gracious,
very
about letting you do this thing. Oops, I had a counter spell.
Exactly. So I think that, like, that would have been really bad manners against somebody who was less experienced and didn't really understand the game. Like, clearly I was just, like, leading him into a trap, but because I knew this person well. And I think that you sort of, if you don't know somebody well, you definitely need to be erring on the side of caution and, you know, communicate clearly, but have a lot of grace, because really, like, I can't overstate how difficult it is to potentially just be playing a game with a whole bunch of cards and combinations of cards that you've never seen before.
I think your question is great, Ethan, and I think you are not the problem. Frankly, I think the Cube events are still in their pubescence and trying to figure out what they are. There really is no precedent for, like, a paid Magic tournament with 30, 60, 100, 200 people. That's not competitive. That's not like, yeah, everyone is there showing up because they want to win more than anything else. And I'll be honest, I am a spike.
I mean, that's every pre-release, right? Like, I don't think it's fair to say there's no precedent for that.
Well, I don't know that I agree.
Pre-releases are less expensive than...
I mean, true. KubeCon is like $250, yeah, I think, all in.
That's
this year.
True, yeah.
Like, it's just, yeah, it's a ton of money. And so, and here's a great example. Like, pre-releases, you often don't have judges that are there at every single table. Like,
yeah,
like, it is a structured Magic event. You're paying judges to be there. You're paying for space. And in those contexts, there really is not a lot of precedence for, like, people just doing it to have fun, right? And frankly, I can't stop with the hot takes. I think the whole CEDH thing is the same sort of growing pains of, like, people don't know how to do this casually. And so, like, people love Commander and they want to escalate, they get more invested, they want to do events, and it's like, well, how do we do that casually? CEDH, we'll do that, we'll play this multiplayer format competitively, that'll surely cause no problems. Anyway, I think that there is a lot of inherited assumptions around what a Magic tournament is that Cube events are running up against. In the same way that they resist optimization in the ways I talked about, in paper, playing Cube in your local community or at one of these small events, I think really resists that competitive nature in a way that I think is quite beautiful. So for example, you mentioned, like, you don't know who your opponents are going to be. At any other Magic tournament, your very first, at a GP, your first opponent could be anybody. And if you keep winning, the more the day goes on, the more you know that your opponent is going to be a very good Magic player, right? Because as you go on, you're going to be paired against other players that are playing really well. And it's just kind of, the longer the tournament goes on, the more people are paired with people of a similar investment level, similar skill, similar whatever. And in these Cube events, we are not doing pairings based on skill, ever. We are always doing pairings based on what cube you want to play. And then within that cube, obviously, yeah, you make it to the finals, you're 2-0, you're probably playing against another player that's at least pretty good. Maybe they got a little lucky. I mean, two wins could be noise, you never know. But your round one opponent in every cube could be literally anybody. And round two just means they won a single game if you won your game, right? Or a single match, rather. So I actually think that if not for that inherited sort of bias around, like, what a competitive Magic event looks like, or what an organized Magic event looks like, I think we would see more Cube events that just did away with anything beyond winning within your pod, right? My spikiness extends to, I sit down at this table, I'm going to open these packs, I'm, you know, trying to do the best I can in this seat. And it doesn't really extend to like, and I want to do it again over there and again over there. And at the end of this weekend, look across the room and say, I am the number one guy in the room, right? Like, that is not particularly appealing to me. It's like, I want to sit down in a draft and do well. And I think what you're feeling is that sort of tension of like, yeah, some people are there and they're treating it like a GP. They have the exact same mentality that they have whenever they went to GPs. And I kind of think it's not that appropriate. And I think that most cube events have not really set the tone enough to make it clear that that's not actually appropriate. And we should actually just be mostly playing for what Judge Bones affectionately calls a cube REL. Like it's a, you know, rules enforcement level where, you know, there's a lot more leeway for things. And we all kind of agree that, like, yeah, first of all, this is way more complicated than any other format. We keep referring to this guy, Judge Bones. He's like the de facto head judge of a lot of these grassroots cube events. He's like made it a mission of his and is willing to travel all over the country to basically head judge these cube events. And he loves it because he's like, look, if I judge a standard night, it's the same three rules interactions over and over again, right? Or whatever, 10 rules interactions. Meanwhile, every cube rules call is like, well, I've never seen that before. Like, yeah, no one's ever called me about these two cards before because there's just such variety in all these different cubes.
I mean, he mentioned even an example that came up that were both standard legal cards, but they're not playable in standard, so it didn't come up.
So it's really complicated. I think people should, generally speaking, have the mentality that, like, you were here to have fun and do your best within the sort of have fun context. But I think what you're feeling is a sort of, yeah, kind of a discomfort in just the fact that there's not a clearly enough established expectations for what the vibe in the room is. And some people show up with, I frankly think, kind of the wrong attitude. I mean, I saw this at Capital Cube Champs, which was the event we were at. Somebody playing against Greg, who is like one of the biggest cube event organizers, as goes to as many events as we do. It was literally, it was a death trigger. Like, it like drained or something when a creature died, and like there was a board wipe cast, and Greg put his cards in his graveyard, and then like 10 seconds later was like, oh yeah, and ping you for one. And they were like, you did put your card in the graveyard already, so I guess you don't get to ping me for one. And Greg was like, okay, great, I guess we're doing that, sure, whatever. Greg was very nice about it. I was sitting next to him and I was kind of fuming, but
I'm feeling a visceral response, like the wind kind of let out of my sails a little bit. Like, I just feel like I want to, it's hard for me to bounce back from that. It would be hard for me to bounce back from that of like, I feel like I thought we were here doing this one thing. You told me we weren't, but then last round I was having to like remind someone about this. So like, what are we doing? Also, like, we paid money to be here and we're not really getting any prize events. So like, we better be having fun. What are we doing here? Like,
and now somebody is like, you missed your trigger on that card. You just read for the first time, like, 40 minutes ago and have never had it before. Like, and you just put it in play. Yeah. And I, honestly, like, I will, I'll be working to try and rid these events of people with that kind of attitude, to be honest, or at least get them to change their attitude and expectations, because I don't think it's particularly appropriate. But
I mean, I've honestly seen that. I've seen that very rarely, but also heard about experiences where people very clearly had that change and like have come up to somebody. I have had that experience, and the person came and apologized to me and they were just like, look, this is my first time here. I didn't get the vibe. I'm so sorry. Like, next time, yeah, I would have conceded to you in turns when I had literally no cards in hand and no permanents in play.
And you had a Teferi Emblem. And instead I took the draw because...
And it's like, yeah, that was literally... That was the first round of the first CubeCon ever. We didn't know what the vibe was. Yeah. Now it's a little more established.
Guys, thank you so much. I am like, I'm realizing we could probably talk for another hour and a half. No. This is just delightful. And it just is all the more reason for us to have you on the show again sometime in the future. Please take a moment to let folks know where they can find you and your content.
You can find everything we do at luckypaper.co. And if it wasn't obvious from this whole conversation, the thing I most want people to take away from this is that Cube is great. And if you're a retail limited player, and let's say maybe you're not like super into Spider-Man or whatever retail limited set is going on right now.
Who could not be super into Spider-Man?
I think I'm sure everybody was really mad when they saw this episode pop up and they were like, no more Spider-Man discourse on Lords of Limited. What the heck?
Yeah.
I think Magic is an ever broadening tent with various goals, and the best way for you to like focus on the part of the game that you really, really love, especially if you love limited, is with Cube. And so I think it feels very intimidating to people. They think, oh, it's too hard to design my own cube. I would mess it up. It would be too bad. Or they think, I'll never get eight people in the same room to play. And our whole shtick is just that you can do that. And so if Cube is even remotely appealing to you and you maybe have felt some of those barriers, I would really encourage you to check us out so you can learn to overcome them, because it truly, if it weren't for Cube, I would not be playing Magic. I would have just stopped. I would have not continued playing Retail Limited. I would have just quit and gone and done something else. So Cube is the best thing about Magic for Anthony and I, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it really is the pairing of the best parts about limited Magic, which is that like idea of solving difficult problems and self-improving, while also having the best parts of Commander, of the creativity and ability to kind of build your own environments and build the kind of Magic that you like to play. And it is true that the most difficult part is getting seven other players to the table.
You can also play with four.
But that's a big part of our mission at Lucky Paper, is to create ways and explain ways and encourage people to find ways to make that happen. And it definitely is worth the effort and worth the work. So yeah, come listen to more of us at Lucky Paper if that appeals to you. We also have set reviews about new cards that people are excited about for cubes, as well as articles about various cube topics, and also just a bunch of other resources for cube people. If you like ever have a Scryfall search that you need to turn into a CSV, I built a tool for that and many other little things. So check all that out.
Yeah. And if it's not clear to folks, I'm just, yeah, huge fan of your show. Keep doing what you're doing. Love listening every week. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And thank you all out there for listening. If you want to find more stuff about our content, you can find it at lordsoflimited.com. There's links to all our episode backlog, our YouTube channel, Twitch streams, respectively, mine and Ben's, as well as our merch, our Patreon page, all of that's at lordsoflimited.com. And if you have any questions or feedback about the show, you can shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Andy and Anthony, for joining us. And we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.